As we're looking at John chapter 12, if you want to turn over there, we're going to continue our study of the book of John and wanted to deal with a couple of things, particularly as we get into John chapter 12. To begin with, let's notice the way that this chapter begins. After, of course, the troublemakers were still trying to kill Jesus. He had left for a while. We don't know between John chapter 11 and verse 54 where it says Jesus didn't move openly among them and they had said, hey, if anybody knows where he is, tell us so we can get him. Between that time and then it says as it was getting close to the Passover in verse 55, not sure exactly how much time passed between those two verses. But then as it's getting close to the Passover, chapter 12 and verse 1 says 6 days before the Passover. Now it was at the time of the Passover feast that Jesus was killed. So this begins what some call the Passion of the Christ. What others say, this is the last week of Christ's life before he dies. Now what's interesting is, you know, later on, and we keep jumping ahead to this, kind of a, not exactly a spoiler, but you know, sometimes you find out something a little later on that's nice to know earlier. We find out later on in the book of John, as he's concluding it, that he says, hey, all the things that Jesus did, there's no way I could have written them all. I just picked a few things to tell you so that it would grow your faith. And we see how clearly that's obvious by the fact that from chapter 12 through chapter 21, nearly half the book deals with just the last week of Jesus' life and then the few things that happen after his death, with his resurrection, and a few events that take place in, you know, just a matter of 3 or 4 different days that are picked up there. Now you think about that for a minute. The bulk of this book, almost half of it, covers what's probably less than 10 days. Maybe 2 weeks at the very most. That's half this book. The other half of the book covered the first 33 years of his life. And of course, you know, really John doesn't even deal with childhood at all. The other thing that we recognize as we look at this is that the emphasis throughout all four of the Gospels is put upon Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection. It's interesting that the religious world as a whole really gets into Christmas. They really get into celebrating Jesus' birth and making a big deal out of that and having a big celebration. Yeah, some of them, you know, they do the Easter thing and celebrate his resurrection on Resurrection Sunday, they call it, and things like that. But the scriptures themselves overwhelmingly put the end of his life, the death, the burial, the resurrection, they put the emphasis heavily on that. There's really only about 3 to 4 chapters, less than 200 verses in all four of the Gospels combined. There's less than about 200 verses that cover Jesus' birth and childhood. And in fact, the first 30 years of his life, up till the time his ministry starts. It's about 200 verses. Now then you've got a few things that cover, you know, John being out there preaching and teaching about Jesus coming. So you've got some of those things. So maybe if you add those in, you'd maybe get up to about 4 chapters out of the entire bulk of the Gospels. Now realize the Gospels, Matthew's 28 chapters, Mark's the short one, it's only 16. Oddly enough, here's food for thought, just a little trivia thing you can trick your friends with. Luke's the longest gospel, even though it's only 24 chapters, while Matthew's 28 chapters, Luke's actually more text. It takes up more pages in your Bible. So it's actually longer, even though it's only 24 chapters. And then John's 21. So you've got some 80 chapters of the Gospels. And out of those 80 chapters, about four of them take care of the first 30 years of his 33 years that he lived, give or take, you know, a few months or whatever. But that's pretty amazing. Four chapters versus, you know, 75, 77, somewhere in there, you know, that covers the rest of it. And what we find then is, even of that covers those last 3 years, his ministry years, the bulk of that is dealing with right up to the end. The last three chapters of Matthew, certainly, even really you can go back even probably back to Matthew chapter 23 where he puts those woes. We talked about that with the false teachers a couple weeks ago. So you could go all the way back to chapter 23, so you've really got six chapters, 23, 24, 25, 26, and 27, 28. So you got six chapters in Matthew. You've got really from Mark 13, 14, 15, and 16, so about four more chapters there, so that's 10. And then in Luke, you've got probably about five chapters or so there from 19 or 20 on. And then here in John, you've got from chapter 12 on through 21 that deals with just that last week. So you're looking at a good 20 chapters or more, 20 to 25 chapters that are dealing with the last week of his life, his death, burial, resurrection, and then the things that happened after his resurrection, the few little events that took place after his resurrection. That's pretty amazing. When you think about how much, nearly a third of the entire gospel accounts are that short period of time. Now, can you imagine if somebody needed to write a book about you and they were going to just cover 1 week of your life? It'd probably be a pretty boring book for most of us, wouldn't it? Most of it. Now, we might have had 1 week in our life somewhere along the line that was a pretty exciting week. But for most of us, you know, it's, well, I got up, had breakfast, went to work. It's not real exciting stuff. Of course, that's what Jesus is. He got up, went to work. But his work was very interesting work that he's doing. And so this 6 days before the Passover feast, and this is going to be, you know, this is the end. Jesus comes to Bethany, which we talked about before. That's just a little town no further than from here to Farmington. You could walk there. I know nobody walks there, but you could walk there. Everybody drives. You know, we drive from here to the fellowship hall, but you could walk there if you were a young person in good health like Jesus at 30, 33 years old. His disciples, they're young, they're healthy, they walked anyway. So they could walk that pretty easily anyway. But it's just within a couple or 5 miles. Just right outside of the edge of town. And this is, if we remember back to just a few chapters, a few verses earlier where Jesus had raised Lazarus from the dead. This is that place. This is where they live, Mary and Martha and Lazarus. That's where Bethany is. And they gave him a dinner there. And Martha served and Lazarus was one of the ones reclining at the table. And, you know, one of the things that we've talked about as we've gone through this study is we've talked about the people who try to find fault with the Scriptures, the people who try to find contradictions, or they try to find falsehoods, or they try to find some problem to say, oh, well, see, that's wrong, the Bible's wrong, it's not really from any God, because it wouldn't say this if it was such. Well, here's another one of those examples. People like to compare. And even though there's not specifically a contradiction, I just want us to learn a little something about when we're doing our own Bible study. Sometimes we'll read, there are four different gospel accounts, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And sometimes we'll read an account in one of them, and then later on, sometimes weeks or even months later, we'll read another account in another one of them, and we'll think, that sounds a lot like that other story. And so we just kind of say, okay, well, you know, that's probably the same story. And that happens even with the so-called scholars. Here we have this case. Jesus is coming. He's sitting at this dinner. Martha's serving. Lazarus is there. And then we have in verse 3, Mary taking a pound of expensive ointment made from pure nard, spikenard it's sometimes called, and anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair. And the whole house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. Now, if you'll keep your finger there in John 12, but if you'll turn over to Matthew chapter 26, in Matthew chapter 26, we read a very similar story. In verse number 6, when Jesus was in Bethany, so he's in the same place, he's in the house of Simon the leper. And there came to him a woman that had an alabaster box of very precious ointment and poured it on his head as he sat at meat. Now, are there some similarities here between these two accounts? There sure are. And in fact, a lot of the so-called biblical scholars say, oh, well, this is the same event. But then that causes problems because then the biblical skeptics look at it and they say, well, wait a minute. This one says that this woman poured this ointment on his head, and over there in John, do you remember what it said over there? It said she poured it on his feet. Well, your head and your feet's not... This is a contradiction. The Bible's not true. Well, what's happened here? They've taken two different events, and they've assumed that it's the same event, and so they said, oh, there's this contradiction. Now, how do we know that it's two different events? If we're going to be Bible detectives, if we're going to be kind of like old Sherlock Holmes or somebody when we come to studying the Bible, we're going to have to use some of the clues that God has put in there for us. Remember what we said when we got to John chapter 12. This was 6 days before the Passover. Well, let's look back to Matthew chapter 26 and notice what happens here. Let's look back in verse 2. In verse 2 it says, what Jesus says to his disciples, you know that after 2 days is the Passover, and the Son of Man is betrayed to be crucified. Now, is 6 days before the Passover and 2 days before the Passover, is that the same day? Well, not the way most calendars keep things. That'd be kind of odd if it was, wouldn't it? So, do you think Jesus didn't eat, you know, every day? Jesus had a meal. You know, we eat every day. If I were to say, you know, tonight that my wife had a dinner with the ladies at the fellowship hall, and then I were to say, well, you know, the first Sunday in March, we had a dinner at the fellowship hall, we would very quickly recognize that the dinner that I was at, where we had at the fellowship hall, same place, same location, they're both even on a Sunday, you know, so a lot of similarities, but that's very different from the one they're going to have tonight, where there aren't going to be any of the men there, it's just going to be the ladies. It's very different. Well, there are some things certainly that are similar. Both cases involve him sitting at dinner. Both of them are in Bethany. Well, of course they're both in Bethany, because he came here to Bethany and had this one 6 days before. And he stays in Bethany up until the time of his triumphant entry into Jerusalem. So he's in Bethany that whole time. You think Lazarus and Mary and Martha are the only people wanted to have Jesus over for dinner? I mean, think about it. If Jesus came to visit us, do you think there'd only be one family here that would want to have him over for dinner? No, we'd all be wanting to get a chance to have him come to dinner and spend some time with him. And that's the way it was when he went to Bethany. This wasn't the same event. And so the so-called discrepancy, the so-called contradiction, doesn't exist because it's two separate dinners. Now what that then tells us is there was two different women that anointed Jesus within the last week of his life. That's okay. That's not a problem. We'll get off that soapbox for a little while. Let's move on. So Mary took this pound of expensive ointment. And she put it on his feet. She wiped his feet with her hair. That tells me she didn't have a short haircut. She must have had some long hair to do that with. But the house was filled with the fragrance. Verse 4 then, but Judas Iscariot, one of the disciples. Now this is the first real information that we have as far as, you know, this is the first thing that's happened that maybe should have been a clue to some of them. But even at that, we probably would have missed it if it wasn't for John pointing it out. Judas Iscariot, one of his disciples, the one who was going to betray him. Well, we wouldn't have known that up to this point otherwise, but John, of course, writing about it from years down the road, kind of a little bit, hindsight's 20/20. Boy, if we'd only known what a bad guy that was back then. Well, you didn't know. Jesus knew, but the disciples didn't. Well, he said, why wasn't this ointment sold for 300 denarii? Now, it's generally believed that a denarii is a day's wage. So if a denarii was a day's wage, and he said this little bottle of perfume, this little ointment that she put on Jesus' feet, could have been sold for 10 months' pay. You ever bought any perfume that costs that much? I know I never had. 10 months' pay, can you imagine? Even at minimum wage, 10 months' pay is a lot of money to spend on a little jar of perfume, a little bit of ointment. But he said, oh, we could have sold this for, and I don't, I guess he was sharp about the cost of things, because he knew how much he could sell that for. He was a real wheeler and dealer, I guess. But then, and he says, it could have been sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor. Boy, don't you think 10 months worth of wages? Boy, don't you think that could feed an awful lot of poor people? Some of these places, you know, they boast about how, you know, for just a dollar a day, they can feed somebody. And they, you know, or for, you know, this amount, they can, just a small amount, and you think, wow, 10 months worth, you could feed a bunch of people. Help out a lot of hungry people, a lot of poor people, buy an awful lot of clothes, coats, blankets, whatever, to give to these poor people. Boy, isn't Judas just a wonderful guy? He's so concerned about the poor, and you know, we should all be concerned about the poor, so boy, isn't he wonderful. But notice verse 6. John tells us, he said this not because he cared about the poor. You ever notice that sometimes people are going to do something very selfish, but they try to play it up as though they're doing something that's just so beneficial to mankind? Oh, we're just going to help everybody out if we just do this. Well, that's the way Jesus... Oh, we sell this, could have sold this to the poor. What is she doing? We could have sold that to the poor. But not because he cared about the poor. You see, he was a faker. He was a hypocrite. He pretended to care about the poor. He didn't care about the poor. What does John tell us he cared about? Well, he was in charge of the money bag. And he used to help himself to what was put into it. He used to embezzle the funds. He was a thief. But he wasn't a robber. He wasn't going to go out with a sword and rob somebody. But he'd just stick his hand in the cash register and pull a little bit out every once in a while he was at work. How important it is to find people who are trustworthy when it comes. And it's a sad thing. Of course, Jesus says it on a number of occasions. He never says it particularly about Judas. But the principle, of course, is there for Judas as well. The one that's faithful in little things will be given much. But if you can't be faithful with a little thing, if you can't be trusted with what belongs to somebody else, who's going to give you something that's your own to have? And here was Judas. I wonder if those messages sunk in on, made him feel guilty at all when Jesus said things like that. Well, if you can't be trusted with the little thing, here he was holding the money bag and sneaking money out of it for his own purposes. Greedy, covetous, thief. Couldn't be trusted to carry the money for somebody else without stealing it. And Jesus basically, you know, earthly things, that's little things. He said, if you can't be trusted with the earthly things, who's going to give you the true treasures, the true riches, the riches of God's Word, of salvation, of forgiveness of sin, of all of these? Who's going to let you have that if you can't even be trusted to keep a few dollars for somebody without stealing them from them? And I tell you what, we've got more and more folks like Judas in our world today. They see something, they don't care who it hurts. They see it and they want it, they're going to grab it. And you can't trust them any further than you can throw them. And that's the kind of person that Judas was. Now, obviously, Jesus knew what was going on the whole time. But the disciples, the rest of the disciples, didn't know. They didn't find out till later about all this stuff, when the Holy Spirit informed them about what had been going on. Imagine if the rest of the disciples had known that Judas was stealing money out of the bag, they'd have probably said, look, somebody else needs to carry the bag. And so why did Jesus allow Judas to be the one that carried the money bag if he knew Judas was a thief? If he knew Judas was taking the money? Well, there's probably a lot of possible answers to that, and the scriptures don't tell us. But the fact of the matter is, there had to be a bad egg in the bunch because Jesus had to be betrayed and crucified. And Judas was that bad egg. Did Judas have a choice? Yeah. He didn't have to take the money. He could have had, and I've seen people say it. They say, you know, I just wouldn't trust myself around that much money. Get somebody else to do it. I can't trust myself that I wouldn't. He could have owned up to it. He could have said, you know, I got this problem. I'm kind of a little covetous with this stuff, and I might be tempted to steal that. Let somebody else carry the money back. But he didn't do that. Of course, he could have fought the urge to steal. Nobody made him steal that. He chose to put his hand in the bag. So he had a lot of opportunities along the way. And after he did it the first time, he could have said, you know, this was wrong for me to do this. He could have come and confessed it, and he could have given the money and said, you know, Jesus, I can't do this anymore. I took some of the money, and look, I'm going to pay it back. He could have done that at any point along the way. Judas could have stopped and said, I'm not going to keep living like this. Now, why do we focus on Judas so much here? What about us in our lives? How many times in our lives are there things where we have a temptation, we have a problem that we're struggling with, we won't come to Jesus with it, we can't stop it on our own, we won't come to anybody else for help about it, and we just keep going down that same path? Look where it led Judas. You do not want to wind up where he wound up. A lot of people do. There are a lot of people who wind up in the same boat. Not that they betrayed the Son of God. I mean, that's obviously, physically speaking, in the sense that Judas did it. But we betray Christ any time we have sin in our lives and continue to allow it to win the victory over us. Jesus came so we could defeat sin. And we can't do it all by ourselves. We do need help. We need help from God. We need help from Christ. We need help from our fellow brothers and sisters in Christ at times as well. And it's not a sign of weakness to ask for help when we need it. It's a sign of strength. If Judas had been stronger, he would have come forward. It's weakness and pride in ourselves that keeps us from confessing our sin and asking for help. And pride, as the Bible tells us, comes before destruction. If Judas had ever humbled himself, he could have escaped the end that he wound up with, where the disciples said he went into his own place. He was the one that Jesus spoke of, said it would have been better for him if he'd never been born than to do the things that he did. So Judas didn't care anything about the poor. He just wanted to take the money out of it. But notice Jesus' response. We're going to stop here after this verse with Jesus, these two verses, Jesus' response. Jesus said, "Leave her alone. She's kept this for the day of my burial." Or the ESV says, "so that she may keep it for the day of my burial." But she's been saving this up for me. And then he says something very interesting. It's a very short but powerful statement, which is the way a lot of Jesus' statements are. "For the poor you have with you always, but you do not always have me." And a truer statement could never have been uttered, for sure. The United States is the richest nation in the world. We have the highest gross domestic product, about the highest average earned incomes of any nation anywhere in the world. Lower cost of living than some of them, higher than some, obviously, but even in this great nation, with all of these material, financial, physical blessings and benefits that we have, do you know what we still have? We have poor people. We have homeless people. Any particular day, like today, there's a certain percentage, a certain number of people that aren't going to eat. Even here in America. Now, that's in spite of the fact that our government, beginning back with Lyndon Johnson and the Great Society, started what has become a war on poverty some 50 years. We've been fighting the war on poverty. Have we won that war? No. Can we win that war? No. Jesus said, you're always going to have poor people. It's just a fact. And our country, probably more than any other country in the world, would be proof that no matter what you do and no matter how hard you try, you can't make Jesus a liar. Our government has poured trillions. Most of the debt, that's $19 trillion in debt that our country has, you know what most of it is? Debt from our government trying to buy stuff for its own people. We're trying to get people to not be poor or pay for certain things, that, you know, the stuff that they need or want or whatever. And that's where most of the debt. Our country is going to wind up bankrupting itself trying to defeat poverty. When Jesus said it 2,000 years ago, you're always going to have the poor with you. Always. Now, does that mean that we shouldn't care about the poor? Well, absolutely not. Jesus cared greatly about the poor. Jesus taught us, certainly, and the disciples teach us very much to care about the poor, to try to help the poor when we can. But look, you could take every person that's, according to our government standards, every person that's in poverty, and you could give them all $1 million tomorrow. Well, you couldn't. I couldn't. Even Bill Gates probably couldn't. But if the government just wrote a check for $1 million and gave it to every person that's living below the poverty level, so-called, and gave it to them tomorrow, at the end of this year, you know what you'd have? You'd have a lot of people below the poverty level. Even if they got $1 million today, by the end of the year, a lot of them would have wasted it, either gambled it away, you know, used it on drugs, or failed business ventures, whatever. A lot of them would have been swindled out of it, had it stolen, this, that, or the other. There'd be poor people again. You're always going to have that. And the same thing is true in the spiritual realm. Spiritually speaking, there are two types of poverty. There are those that Jesus talked about in the Sermon on the Mount who are poor in spirit, meaning that they recognize their need for God. They recognize their own human failings and weaknesses. That kind of poor in spirit, that kind of poverty spiritually, is a good quality that we all need to have, to recognize we need God, we need a Savior, we need someone to help us. But then there's another kind of poverty when it comes to spiritual things, and that is those that just have found no interest and find no value in spiritual things. And they're poor in spiritually speaking in a different way. And that's not a good thing. And you know what? We're always going to have that kind of people too. No matter how eloquently the gospel is taught, no matter how friendly and kind and loving we are, no matter how perfect an example of Christianity we set, there will always be some people who will reject Christianity and reject spiritual things. They're just not spiritually minded people. Does that mean we should say, well, forget my example then. Forget trying to be kind to people, and I shouldn't even bother because there's going to be... No. We still need to live the best we can to live for Christ. To win the most that we can for Christ. We need to be like Mary, who put Christ first, who was willing to sacrifice something of great physical, monetary value, emotional value. I mean, if you imagine if you had something that cost that much, it'd be pretty dear to you. She was willing to sacrifice that for Jesus. What are we willing to give up for Jesus? A couple hours on Sunday? That's not enough. We've got to dig deeper. We've got to give Him more of our lives. He doesn't want a couple or 3 hours a week or something like that. That's not what He wants. He wants our heart, mind, soul, and strength. That's what's going to make us pleasing to Him. We've got to give Him everything that we have and everything that we are. It's got to be His. And it's got to be things that we use for His glory. If you're here tonight and not been living a life that's pleasing to God, if you've been just giving Him half your heart, it's not good enough. If you've just been making Jesus part of your life, let me tell you, Jesus doesn't want to be part of your life. Now let that sink in for a minute. Well, yeah, Jesus. No, Jesus doesn't want to be part of your life. Jesus wants to be your life. He wants to be your everything. He wants to be your all, as the song we sing says. He doesn't want to be part of your life. He wants to be Lord of your life, master of your soul, King enthroned upon your heart. If you need to respond to His invitation to put Him where He belongs and not be like Judas and griping and whining about how something ought to be different, but just put yourself over, devote yourself to the Lord the way Mary did. If you need to do that, please do so as we stand and as we sing tonight.